Morning, everyone.
Morning.
Glad you're here. I do see a couple new faces, so I'll just take a minute to explain that we have a teaching team. It's never the same, well, it's rarely the same person from Sunday to Sunday up here, and I'm one of the members of the teaching team, so I hope it works out okay between you and I today, but if it doesn't, come back next Sunday because it will be somebody different. All right. So we are mostly, we're nearly done with our series, Strength to Love. And as you know, it's based on the book, Strength to Love, by Martin Luther King Jr. And we are, have we been primarily working with one of the sermons in that book, Paul's letter to American Christians. And I'm going to be doing one of the last few bits. Ginny will be doing some of the last few bits next Sunday. And then on the 17th, we're going to have kind of a Q&A where you can ask the teachers questions, give us feedback, but also tell us how the series affected you. What were some of the takeaways for you? Because we would love to hear about that. And also feel free to say, what do you wish we had talked about? Or what are some things you would like to see in the future? Yeah, that's that. Okay, so we've heard from several teachers, Wayne, Jeremy, April Lynn, Kevin, Andrew. You're going to hear from me. You're going to hear from Ginny next week. And we've heard from this series as we listen to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Channel Paul. We've heard some of the advantages that our culture gives us, but in addition, those advantages give us a false sense of who we are. In the messages prior to mine, we've heard how our economic system can contribute to inequality, how our desire for comfort and security and safety has made us complacent to the needs of others who aren't experiencing the world the way we do, how an emphasis on right belief contributes to disunity among churches, disunity between Christians and people of other faiths. And I've been touched these last few weeks by the humility and the grace that the teachers employed while opening up Dr. King's words to us. So here's the section for the book today. And again, it's one of the last paragraphs in the message, Paul's letter to American Christians. So here we go. God is love. He who loves has discovered the clue to the meaning of ultimate reality. He who hates stands in immediate candidacy for non-being. American Christians, you may master the intricacies of the English language, and you may possess the eloquence of articulate speech. But even though you speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not love, you are like sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. You may have the gift of scientific prediction and understand the behavior of molecules. You may break into the storehouse of nature and bring forth many new insights. You may ascend to the heights of academic achievement so that you have all knowledge. And you may boast of your great institutions of learning and the boundless extent of your degrees. But devoid of love, all of these mean absolutely nothing. But even more, Americans, you may give your goods to feed the poor, you may bestow great gifts to charity, and you may tower high in philanthropy. But if you have not love, it means nothing. You may even give your body to be burned and die the death of a martyr, and your spilled blood may be a symbol of honor for generations yet unborn, and thousands may praise you as one of history's supreme heroes. But even so, if you have not love, your blood is spilled in vain. You must come to see that a man may be self-centered in his self-denial and self-righteous in his self-sacrifice. His generosity may feed his ego and his piety, his pride. Without love, benevolence becomes egotism and martyrdom becomes spiritual pride. Wow. Like the Apostle Paul, whom Dr. King emulates in these words, Dr. King does not pull any punches. And his words require us to truly examine our behavior and our actions and our motives. His words, especially that passage we just read, remind me that I live in a culture at a time where I am constantly catered to. My comfort, my priorities, my desires, my needs, my wishes. I always have choices, I always have options in absolutely every arena of my life. Everything. The food I eat, the clothes I wear, where I live, what job I can have, what car I drive, where my kids go to school, the church I worship in, whom I vote for, where I vacation, and on and on and on. I always have choices. Choices built into our economic system, our political system, our entertainment system, our news, and on and on and on. And that seems like a good idea, right? Choices, options, that's good. But there is a hidden cost to having so many available options. And that is, in having multiple options available, I can often and far too easily avoid doing the hard thing, the difficult thing, the uncomfortable thing. I can often and far too easily avoid making difficult choices because the easy choice, the appealing choice, the comfortable choice, it's always available to me. It's always on the table, on the menu, in a ballot option, in a conversation, in the newspaper I read, in a conversation I have, and on and on and on. I also always have the option to look away, to walk away, to even pretend I did not hear or see something. There always seems to be a less difficult choice I can make, even when my professed values, my professed faith in God, or my conscience tell me that the hard thing is what I should do, what I should choose. And then to complicate this further, I can even make the right choice, the loving choice, but for the wrong reasons. So this brings me to one of the questions in this series that's been in the background. King's words have brought this question to the forefront for me. What does love require of us? What does this way of love, this way of walking in the world, require? And part of the answer lies in the title of the book, Strength to Love. It takes strength to love. It takes a strength that's made up of courage and compassion and empathy. And where does this strength come from? How can we develop the kind of love that we need to embody in this world? Does love even make sense? Does it change anything? Is it realistic? Let's face it, can love really change what's going on in our world today? Inequality, abuse of power, dysfunctional institutions? All of the problems in our world, big picture problems, such as discrimination, abuse of resources, over-the-top rhetoric, and a deeply, deeply polarized government here in the United States. And more minor picture problems, such as families and friends who can no longer have conversations about the country that they live together in. Family and friends who can no longer have conversations about the faith they share. I hesitate to say this, but the question, does love even make sense, isn't a valid question. It doesn't matter. Because from where I stand today, it's actually an irrelevant question, a pointless question. Because for those of us who say that we follow the Rabbi Jesus, love is a requirement. We are mandated to love. As Ruth Haley Barton says, love is the deepest calling of the Christian life, the standard by which everything about our lives is measured. And she goes on to say, For the Christian person, the choices we make are always about love, and which choice enables us to keep following God into love. There may be other factors to consider, but the deepest question for us as Christian people is, what does love call for in this situation? What would love do? And Ruth Haley Barton continues. She says, why is it that we so rarely ask this question relative to the choices we face? What distracts us from love in various situations in which we are trying to discern God's will? I don't know your answers to this question, she says, but I can tell you a few of mine. For one thing, love is a major inconvenience at times. It's rarely efficient. Furthermore, love challenges my self-centeredness, and it sometimes requires me to give more of myself than I want to give. Sometimes love hurts, or at least it makes me vulnerable. All the time, love is risky, and there are no guarantees. Do her words resonate with you? They do for me. So what I'm learning through this series, through being a follower of Jesus, is that without love, nothing will change, or at least nothing will change for the better. But love, courageous, compassionate, empathetic love, can change things. And you likely have examples and situations from your own life that you could share where love did change things. So for today, I've chosen two examples from history. Don't groan, but that's my thing. These are big examples, kingdom versus empire examples. They are relevant, they are inspiring, and they give me hope that love does work. And I chose them because they illuminate in a big way what courage, compassion, and empathy can accomplish. What happens when you do have strength to love? And you can argue with me afterwards in the conversation if you want that I have oversimplified the past, that it is way more complicated than what I'm going to tell you now, and it's way more multi-layered, and you are right. But I'm looking at these examples through this perspective of the choices that we make can change the future. My first example comes from the civil rights movement in this country. The civil rights movement began long before the tumultuous decade of the 1960s, but I was a young teenager in the 1960s, and so that is the decade in which my memories of the civil rights movement begin. Dr. King, the author of our book, had been involved in the civil rights movement for years. The movement's overall strategy combined litigation, the use of mass media, boycotts, demonstrations, as well as sit-ins and other forms of civil disobedience to turn public support against institutionalized racism, and in the hopes of making real reform in United States law. But this strategy required a willingness for thousands of black and white Americans to be arrested in the cause of ending segregation and advancing civil rights, thereby flooding the jails, overwhelming the judicial system, and eventually, as we know, ultimately changing public opinion about segregation. People had to make hard choices. In 1962, Dr. King held a prayer vigil outside the city hall in Albany, Georgia. So for praying outside of a public building, he and hundreds of others were arrested and put in jail. And during this time in jail, by the way, this particular jail in Albany, Georgia, in the South, was filthy and very dangerous. It was one of the worst jails in the South. While in these conditions, this is when Dr. King began to work on this book, Strength to Love. While this nation showed black Americans its worst face, Dr. King continued to give this nation his best. When faced with a choice, he chose the difficult way of love. And eventually, due to the efforts of hundreds of thousands of people who made the same choice, change began to happen. The Civil Rights Act was passed, but as we well know, there is much more that needs to be done in this country to have it live up to its own ideals of liberty and justice for all. I have another example from history. My husband Tom and I and the Whites, Brian and Kathy, we were able to go to South Africa. We just got back a few weeks ago. And if you have been anywhere near us in the last few weeks since we've been back, we have talked your ears off about South Africa. And you may have heard this story from me, because this for me was an overwhelming experience. Shoot. There were lots of things I was looking forward to in South Africa, but number one on my list was, honey, could you give me some Kleenex? Number one on my list was to go to Robben Island. Oh, another honey. Thanks, sweetie. Thanks, Dan. Number one on my list was to go to Robben Island. I had read Nelson Mandela's book, A Long Walk to Freedom. Made a tremendous impact on me. Robben Island is an actual island you can see from the big city of Cape Town where we were staying. It's a small island, mostly flat. There's like just one kind of hill. It's hard rock island. We spent the morning there. The various colonial powers in Africa, primarily the Dutch and the English, used the island as a penal colony in the 16, 17, and 1800s, also as a place to send lepers and anyone that they deemed insane. However, beginning in the 1960s, Robben Island served as South Africa's maximum security prison, because there's no escape possible from that island. And it was the prison was increasingly filled with people of color, a non-white population of black men, and even black children as young as 11 or 12 were placed in this maximum security prison because they were sentenced there for political offenses such as calling for an end to apartheid. Apartheid, as you well know, was the official legal system of racial segregation in South Africa. A system that separated people based on skin color. It was a hierarchy of color. A system that affected every area of life, marriage, employment, housing, education. A system that ensured that the white minority would retain political, economic, and social dominance over the non-white population. Now here's something that makes this tour of Robben Island so fascinating, and it was something I didn't know until we were there. All the tour guides on Robben Island are former prisoners. So you are hearing from the people who actually were sentenced there for 15, 20, 30 years for a crime such as picking up a rock and throwing it into a window. During the time that Nelson Mandela and other members of the ANC, the African National Congress, the party that was agitating for change, during the time that these prominent members were incarcerated on Robben Island, they endured inhumane conditions, such as they were given less food than the white prisoners. They slept on cement floors. Sometimes they were given a thin mat. The white prisoners had beds, mattresses. They were given insufficient clothing for the weather. It's a really harsh climate. It's down there by the Cape of Good Hope, you know. So storms come in. They were only allowed to wear shorts year-round. It was freezing. The cells are open to the environment. I mean, there's bars, but the wind, the rain, the cold, the heat, when it was hot, it's all there. And they were sentenced to hard, grueling manual labor on the island in quarries. Despite this incredibly harsh punishment, the political prisoners remain committed to a better future for all South Africans. not just themselves. Ahmed Kathrada, he's a man of Indian descent. He was imprisoned on Robben Island for his role in the struggle to end apartheid. His words recall what they endured. "We cannot forget the quarry where we mined stone. We came back with blisters, bloody hands, and sore muscles. And we cannot forget the dozen years or more when we were forced to sleep on cold cement floors. Also, we cannot forget the cold showers. Once a week, you could have a cold shower. 14 years of cold showers. I'm going to add more. That's not up there. Nelson Mandela was allowed one visitor every 10 years who could speak to him for 5 minutes. These are what all of the political prisoners endured. There is so much more one can recall, much more we have found in ourselves to forgive. But these we will never forget. Even in prison, they consistently chose to work for a future that would create a unified country of equals for all in South Africa. So during this time, the prisoners used the few moments each day when they could speak to each other, to teach the illiterate prisoners to read, to discuss ideas for South Africa's future, to petition for better conditions. And this was only possible because the government made a serious tactical error. They were so concerned about keeping the political prisoners away from the general population, the general prison population, that they unintentionally created conditions for the political prisoners to further develop the goals and strategies to lead the country away from apartheid. They had time, uninterrupted time sometimes, to talk among themselves and plan for this future. And what was the result of this? The result was that the prisoners developed a Bill of Rights for the nation they were trying to create. And they also wrote a document that became the interim constitution for the nation when apartheid finally ended. In a country with a black majority and a white minority, many whites assumed that they would be at the mercy of the newly elected government. But the transition document, the transition constitution, was a document focused on building a non-racial, non-segregated country where everyone's human rights were respected and, most importantly, protected. Not reprisals, not retaliation. Other examples from history, and I promise I won't talk any more about this, it would be the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was led by Desmond Tutu in South Africa, the peace process in Ireland that actually transformed the conflict in Northern Ireland. So what I'm trying to tell you here is choosing the difficult path of love can, history shows us, create an environment that creates the potential for flourishing of all. I'm not naive. There are still myriad problems in South Africa and other places around the world. But choosing the difficult path of love at least creates the possibility for flourishing for all. In a few days, there's going to be an election in this country. I don't know if you guys know that. I don't know if you're aware. Oh my gosh. According to the polls, whatever the result of the election, 50% of this country is going to be deeply unhappy. We are going to need strength to love. We need to walk the way of love. There's an old saying, it might be a proverb, I don't know, but it goes like this. The road is made by walking. Think about that for a minute. We make the road by walking. And again, for me, that phrase evokes hope and possibilities. So now bear with me while I talk about some things I have learned, some things I'm still trying to learn about the way of love in the world, what it means to have this necessary strength to love, the kind of love I see in Jesus, the kind of love I actually see in some of you. It's a way of walking in the world that creates hope and possibilities. These are the things that I'm trying to learn to help me walk in this path, some steps I've gleaned from the series. And again, in the conversation later today, I would love to hear your ways. How have you decided to walk in love in the world? So the first thing is the basic one. Begin with the inward journey. Too many of us do this backward. We start with what's out there, faith, social media, politics, family arguments. And then we try to see how faith or religion can make it better, like maybe bolster our arguments, prove that we're on the right side. But what if our starting place for engaging with the world, engaging with each other, engaging with actually anything, was rooted in our participation in divine love, was rooted in the Trinitarian flow of God's love, the mutual love within the Trinity that overflows, embracing all of life, the knowledge that all of us are made in the divine image, and therefore, all of us should be doing work that's based within God's intended and preferred future for the world. Glimpsing this love that's in the within the Trinity, this love that overflows to us, is like a vision we could live with. This guy, and actually I don't know who he is, but it was a great quote. It is a glimpse, this vision of participating in Trinitarian love. It is a glimpse of creation's purpose and a glimmering of the Spirit's movement amid the world's present pain, brokenness, and despair. This vision also recognizes the inevitable journey of inward and outward transformation, the simultaneous, continuing transformation of the inward hearts of people liberated by God's astonishing grace, and the outward transformation of social and economic structures liberated by God's standards of justice. Contemplative practices help with this inward journey, which is why we take time each month to have a contemplative service. And I encourage you to lean into contemplative practices. I am, by nature, not a contemplative person. And Ginny's going to fall out of her chair right now. But one of the things that I have found very helpful is the practice, the contemplative practice, get ready, Ginny, the prayer of examine. She knows that I've had very strong feelings about that because I just felt it was the most guilt-inducing contemplative practice on the planet. But apparently it's not. So the way the prayer of examine works is that at the end of the day, and I'll use me, I reflect on the day's events to discover if there were any moments when I was connected with God's love, any moments when I did walk the way of love. And it also tells you, as you're going through this prayer of examine, what are some of the opportunities you missed, or maybe an opportunity that you misused, not to make us or me feel bad, but as a teaching tool to make us more aware of God's loving presence all day long, wherever we are. And hopefully to transform me into someone who will join hands with God in the world, because we make the road by walking. The second practice that has been helpful to me, and when I say helpful, I just mean like I'm learning this, because you guys know me, and if you don't know me, you'll meet me in the conversation or you'll meet me in the upcoming days and go, whoa, she is nothing like those four things that she talked about. And that's right, I am nothing like that, but I am trying, I'm going that way, I'm hoping I'm going that way. So my second thing that I'm trying is to be curious, not judgmental. Any Ted Lasso fans out there? This comes from the Church of Ted Lasso, and it's really, really helpful. There are lots of hot button issues out there, lots of uncomfortable situations, and sometimes we just react, right? You hear something, you just clench, you react. We aren't really thinking our way through whatever was said, whatever situation we're in. And if we identify with a particular point of view or a side, we often just pop off with the stock phrases or quotes that our side utilizes, or we react to the stock phrases that the other side uses. And it means we're not listening. So that's why it means we're not curious at all about the person that we're talking to. We're judging. And we're not very good judges. As Brian McLaren says, our judging is frequently ignorant, biased, retaliatory, and devaluing. So when we judge, we inevitably misjudge. So choose to be curious. Ask questions. Can you tell me why this is an important issue for you? or it sounds like you value this. Tell me more about that. The starting point for all of our interactions with others must begin with the fact that we have equal worth, equal value, and we share the divine image. Basically, listen to others in the same way you would like others to listen to you, because we make the road by walking. 3, educate yourselves. Sometimes I feel very powerless because of my own ignorance. I don't have answers, other people don't seem to have answers, and the world's problems just seem immense, insurmountable. I don't even know where to begin thinking about something. And I often shortcut my thinking with these knee-jerk reactions. Or I judge somebody else's solution as absolutely ridiculous without even being curious about what the solution is really about. But being willing to be taught and being willing to learn is another way to effect change. It's a way of bringing wisdom into situations, and we definitely need wisdom these days. For several years, immigration has been one of the issues that seems to defy solutions. It's just one of those problems that just seems so complex, or it seems to defy mutually agreeable solutions. And it just seems so complicated, and it is. So I threw my hands up. I give up. I don't have anything. I can't help in this situation. But if I take the time to learn, which I've been trying to do, to become more informed about this immense juggernaut of what we call immigration, as I've been reading from a variety of sources, looking for more nuanced reporting, this has helped. I don't feel as powerless. And also, I have found that there are organizations that do take a compassionate and informed response to those coming to our borders, to migrants. And this has become very helpful to me, because I'm becoming aware, despite all the sound and fury filling the airwaves and print, there is a way to walk in love in complicated situations. And there are some things I can do, because again, we make the road by walking it. 4, pray for the people with whom you disagree. You've all seen those cutouts of celebrities or famous people, right? Those cardboard things, super one-dimensional. If I dislike someone, I see them like a cardboard cutout. They're not a real person to me. They're just whatever issue they have that irks me. They're less than a person. And I can say with confidence, I'm wrong, and they're... No, that's not what I want to say in confidence. They're wrong, and I'm right. But when I start to pray for that person, and most cases I have to continually pray for that person, it's like they get skin on. They become real. They're no longer that cardboard cutout. I begin to see them differently, and I can acknowledge that they are more than the issue I reduce them to. They are someone with fears and wounds and scars, just like I have. They are someone loved by God, just as I am. Someone created in the divine image, like me. We pray for the ones we disagree with, because we make the road by walking it. I began this message with a quote by Ruth Haley Barton, who reminded us that we are mandated to love. You know, people asked Jesus a lot of questions in the Gospels, didn't they? And often he answered them with another question or something that sounds very ambiguous. But one time, he gave a direct answer. Tell me, teacher, what is the most important thing that God commands in the law? Jesus says, the most important commandment is this: Hear, O Israel, the Eternal One is our God, and the Eternal One is the only God. You should love the Eternal, your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second commandment is this: Love others in the same way you love yourself. There are no commandments more important than these. In other places, Jesus pointed out that loving your neighbor is loving God, which means that loving God is both as easy and as difficult as loving your neighbor. He said, "For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." And then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you a drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of my brothers, you did it to me." I'm going to end there because I went a little bit long. I'm going to ask the band to come up. And then will you all pray with me? Holy One, we call on you for your wisdom, your strength, and your love. God, keep us from diluting our love with fear or anger. Keep us from limiting our love with the ideas of who deserves it and who doesn't. Lord, give us the strength to love. Help us be loving amid fear and anger. Help us remain loving in our hearts and our minds and all of our actions. May we be aware that every moment is an invitation to choose love. May we be aware that you walked the road that you are asking us to walk. Lord, again, give us strength to love. Amen. So I don't normally ask